and we'll get going, okay? Settled out so we can get going. But people went out to get rehydrated.
Everyone, if we can be seated, we're about to get started with our Esrog.
Okay, very appropriate that you all went out to get rehydrated. The Esrog is a plant that needs a lot of water. That's why, in fact, you'll see in a moment, one of the reasons for the name of Esrog is called, comes from the word Hadar, which is really hydro in Greek. So there you go. Anyways, welcome. My name is Moshe Yeris, and I'm going to speak to you about the craft to graft. This is not financial graft. This is about the craft to graft, the super special, super duper esrogim, and how the Easter of grafting of Harkavah developed in the beginning about the 16th century onto the modern era. And I just want to begin by just referring to the dedications that are made for this year. First of all, as you know, the entire series is dedicated by Michael and Marsha Lax in memory of Michael's parents, Ben and Leah Lax, Dov Ben Mordechai Zal, and Leah Bat Tovia Zal. And specifically, this year is dedicated by Joseph and Ruth Rudner in honor of Dr. Patricia Bukin, I hope I pronounced that name correctly, who is working at the Volcani Institute in Israel for her work in the field of botany. And I just want to say it's the first time anyone has ever made a dedication to my shir that is topical. So thank you very much. It's very special. And also it's being dedicated by Neville and Richter in memory of Yosef Chaim ben Yehuda Leib Zal and Sardina Bas Yaakov Yosef Zal, Yisroch ben Nechemi Zal, and Henya Bas Avram Zal, Neshama Shnei Ben Aliyah. And of course, once again, we're really in honor of Dr. Patricia Bucky, who's doing all this good work in botany in Israel itself. Okay, so before I begin, actually, I want to just to take you and show you the picture on the page 5 of the handout. It's one of the pictures worth 1,000 words. I often wondered whether really this idea of grafting esrogim was really an issue, not an issue. Is someone making this up? Is this simply a financial ploy? Every time they go in, they say, we have a special hashkacha there. And if you look on page number 5 of my handout, this actually, I took it off the internet. The internet, of course, is font of all wisdom, but I believe it's legit from the Etsy site. And it's an ad by a Mighty Oak Tree Nursery, and I don't even know where this is. But they are selling an etrog tree for $88.93 US. I can't import it into Canada, so I didn't try. And as you can see, if you read the script below the pictures, these are actually pictures from the site. They came out much better on my phone than on the computer, so I just zipped them off of that. But you notice that it says they're selling you a 12-foot tall etrog citron tree, which is twice as high as me. And what's the word after that? Grafted.
Person 1 to 2 feet.
I'm sorry, my mistake. 1 to 2 feet. Thank you. 1 to 2 feet. There you go. Okay, 1 to 2 feet, which is like this. Okay, there you go. Okay, 1 to 2 feet. I've tried to dabble in planting etrogim trees much earlier in my life, and I've never got an etrog off of them, and that's because this is North America. I do know my brother tried, and he was actually able to get an etrog off a tree. Coming off a pot and so forth. But the most fascinating thing about seeing this was it is identified as a grafted citron tree. And for the life of me, I don't know who the target audience is really meant to be. They're showing off, they're advertising to you. We want you to know this is a grafted tree. Now, you and I know, if you don't know, that one of the prohibitions that we're concerned about is about not having a grafted etrog. It's called bilti murkav. It should not be grafted. That's exactly what I want to talk to you about. So I'm not quite sure who the target audience, and in fact, if you looked at the ad, it said it's low stock. I don't know if they've sold them out or they only made one or two that they're trying to get rid of. But let's talk about what this really is. I want to do two things here. I want to talk to you about what the Issur really comes from, where it is, how Chazal understood it, and then if we have time at the end to kind of give you share a bit of the vociferous nature of the financial arguments in the middle of the 19th century that surfaced around the Etrogim in Corfu, Greece. So first of all, if you look in the source pages that you have here, the first source, of course, is... let me back up a step. So, well, let's look at this. So the first source, of course, the pasuk that comes up in Vayikra 23, look, you should take for yourself on the first day, fruit of a good tree, branches of palm trees, and boughs of fig trees, and willows of the brook. This is what we're telling you exactly what you should be taking. This is the written law. And in the oral law, the Talmud itself goes to great detail to identify what these are. Nowhere is the word etrog used in the actual Torah. So how do we know it really is an etrog? How, maybe it could be a persimmon, maybe it could be an apple, maybe it could be a pear, maybe it could be an orange. Well, actually, it could be an orange because there weren't oranges in Israel in the ancient world. But who knows what kind of fruit? Maybe it's a pomegranate of some sort. So the actual Talmud goes through it, and they try to understand clearly that why would this be an etrog? Because they give various interpretations. It's the fruit of a beautiful tree, which means that the taste of the tree trunk and the taste of the fruit are alike. And by the way, I can tell you that the taste of the leaves on many citrus fruits, not only the etrog in general, we're going to taste very similar to what the peel of the etrog or the peel of the citrus fruits are. It's just the genetically the way they're set up. So this is actually true. And what about the other citrus fruits? They probably did not exist in Israel in the days of the Bible. The only citrus fruit is citrus medica, is this citrus fruit that was not just a good fruit to eat. Well, it's not a good fruit to eat, but does have some fruit in the middle, but was also considered to have medicinal properties, which is why it's called citrus medica. And then the Talmud discusses, well, maybe the word hadar has got other origins for it. Don't read hadar, the beautiful fruit, but rather hadir. It's like a pen, because like in the pen where you keep the sheep, there are big ones and small ones. So too that there are dvogim who are bigger and smaller. They don't necessarily fall off at the end of the season, which is true. They can remain from year to year until they're manually removed from the tree. And then it goes through some other reasons as well. That's what the first one is. And Rabbi Avol says, don't read it hadar, but hadar, which means it goes from year to year. And Ben Azai says, don't read hadar, but rather hidur or idur, which is, of course, the Greek language word for hydro. You'll recognize that from your electric bill. Of course, it took me a while when I came to Canada to understand that if I asked for hydro, I was really asking for electricity. Okay. Mm-hmm. But the point of it being that this is the fruit that grows, needs a lot of water to maintain itself. It is a very thirsty kind of a plant. And calling it a hidur and calling it a hydra type of plant is going to be significant. So the Chazal actually go through great work to try to identify that this is what the actual fruit is. Nowhere in this identification does the issue of grafting come up. Okay, and in fact, if you look in the history of growing etrogim, nowhere in the Talmud does it come up about the issue of grafting being a prohibition. The Shulchan Aruch does not mention the issue of prohibition of grafting. The Rambam doesn't mention the issue of prohibition of grafting. The first time that you do find it is probably in the Levush Mordechai, which is a little bit about the same time as the Shulchan Aruch, but does come up, and I'll show that to you in a moment. But before that, you don't really find the issue of grafting. Now, by the way, why would you want to graft an etrog? Anybody know? Why, what's the idea? It makes it hardier. In fact, if I read an article that said a regular etrog, and probably may apply to certain other citrus, but specifically the etrog, that the root ball is fairly fragile. And consequently, you're going to get maybe 15 years out of a good etrog tree. If you graft root, if you graft these branches onto another sock, which is hardier, you can get 35, 40 years off of this the growth. Well, that sounds financially like it makes a whole lot of sense to me, but unfortunately, halachically, it does not sound like it works, and that's really where the problem actually is. So that's one reason. Now, why do you not hear about it before the 16th century? Well, probably, there could be a lot of reasons. You could argue, I suppose, if you were a skeptic, well, they were doing it all the time, so there never were any questions until the 16th century for some reason. But the more logical reason is it probably was not developed. They probably didn't have the knowledge or wherewithal to move it onto other trees. Or more importantly, there was no other citrus trees in the land of Israel. The first other citrus fruit that moves into the land of Israel is not the Jaffa orange. The Jaffa orange is a modern invention. Jaffa oranges come from Turkey. When they started importing and building and growing the Jaffa oranges in Israel, they said, we can't call them Turkish oranges. It doesn't sell. We're going to call them Jaffa oranges, the kachava. But the first actual citrus fruit besides the etrogim was actually the lemon, and that really doesn't come into the Middle Ages. So there actually are no other citrus fruits in the ancient Near East except what we call the etrog. And it's a pretty nice looking fruit. So when the Torah says this is a beautiful looking fruit, it makes sense. It's surely a whole lot nicer than a pomegranate. It's even nicer looking than an apple and pear and persimmon, you know, whatever you want to choose and compare it to. So, and orange, there were no oranges, lemons, there are no lemons, etc., etc. So it is possible that it's probably not until the 16th century that there is a sufficient number of other citrus fruits growing that they could conceptually begin to look at whether they could graft it successfully to ensure or to enhance the longevity of the Etrogan themselves. That's really why this situation only comes up in the last, since the 16th century or so. Now, the reasons why a citrus or an esrog that is grafted is going to be puzzle, I'll just tell them to you very quickly, and then we'll look at some of the chuvos themselves. The reason that it's really puzzle, there's a number of reasons suggested by the different Rishonim and Achronim, I should say. First of all, the fruit of the etrog, as we know, must be whole. It has to be tamim, and that be missing a part of it. If you have half an etrog, it's not good. If you got three quarters of an etrog, if you took a bite out of an etrog, it's something significant is missing, it's wrong. So therefore, the grafted etrog may be considered as being partially from etrog and partially from, let's say, whatever the stock is, lemon stock. So it's really not a full etrog. It's three quarters etrog, half etrog. Or it's possible that the identity of the fruit is determined by the fruit of the tree on which it appears, which means that the grafted etrog is not even considered an etrog at all, but rather it's considered a lemon because you look at where the source is sourcing from. In fact, there's a lot of arguments that some of the Achronim tried to suggest that the appearance of an etrog that grew on a grafted tree is going to be different. It won't be as bumpy. The seeds will be laid out in a different way. It's not going to have an indented type of, not a pitum, but an indented type of ukitz, which is the stem on the bottom. They argue about it. The truth is, in terms of botany, we don't find that these really hold water. A grafted fruit is going to look like, taste like a grafted fruit, smell like a grafted fruit, look like a grafted fruit. Whether you're grafting apples onto a pear tree or whether you're going to be grafting an etrog onto a chushkush or onto a lemon tree, it's going to look the same way. So they had this feeling it was going to be some kind of an influence upon it. Another kind of an issue that comes up and what I would be puzzled is because you may be adding an additional species called baltosif. You know, you can only have a tzitzis, you can only have so many strands, four boxes of tefillin, you have five boxes, it's baltosif, four objects into your lulav, esrog, hadas, maravos. And if you're going to take an esrog that is also partially a lemon, because it grew on a lemon stock, but what you really have is now you have an esrog and you have a lemon, you've got a fifth species mixed in there, it's baltosif. And then one of the other reasons that is suggested is really about the fact that we're prohibited to graft and to mix species together in general. We read some of that yesterday's parsha. You can't mix species in the animal kingdom. You can't mix species in the plant kingdom. The Torah feels that the Almighty made a world. We have to develop it and accept it and use it. We can't go making new different types of things. So if someone else made it, like you have, what do we call it? Nectarine, I think, is a mixed fruit, right? If that's fine as well, you can eat it and you can even make a broth on it. But for a mitzvah, you're going to go against the graces of Hashem, who didn't create this kind of mixed thing of a grafted together. So but you're doing an avera to make it. So that's why it would not be able to be done to be used for the esrogim. So this is really, these are the themes behind it. Let's kind of take a look at some of the chuvas very quickly. Just give you a sense of this, and I do want to leave myself a few minutes to talk about the Corfu issues. Are the issues in the 1800s with the etrogan from Corfu, Greece. So if you look in source number 3, this is really from the Levush. This is probably the earliest tshuva that comes up, the earliest reference to it. Levush writes in Levush Mordechai, Simon Tuf, Reish Mem Ted, 549. He says, it should be actually not Tuf, Reish, it should be 649, I guess, right? Kuf, Reish, Shin. Kuf, no, 549. There are those who wish to permit those esrogim that came from the orchards called gardenzi. I'm not sure where they are. And I say that they are unfit to the Torah, for it is known that they are hybrids. And a branch from each esrog is grafted onto an orange or lemon tree or vice versa. Now this means that the transgression of grafting two species has been done. And even if a non-Jew does it, it's still wrong to do so. And therefore, since the transgression has been performed on this, even though it's permissible to be eaten, it's still considered it's ma'us. It's obnoxious, it's abominable to the Most High, and therefore this is what I see, and this is what I'm going to tell you to do. So that was a situation that came up in terms that the Levush really refers to. The number of other cases come up, for example, the Maharam al-Sheikh mentions a tshuva in his tshuva, and he only put the beginning of it in source number 4, and that the Maharam al-Sheikh talks about the fact that there was once a rabbi in Tzfat. I'll just tell you briefly what the tshuva is, I see it and put it here. There was a rabbi in Sfat who wanted to permit the use of hybrid etrogim. The entire rabbin of the city was against it. And the Shach, Moshe Alshech writes several reasons for the prohibition, some of which I mentioned to you before, some of which that it becomes really a salemin, some of which it's a mixture and so forth. And for example, it may be less than its required shear. If I only have half an etrog, it might not be large enough to be what the shear is. So Rabbi Alshech actually writes in the end, he says, like, it's obvious to him that it's no good, and he would not have even bothered to write this tshuva, but he accepts there's this one rabbi in Tzfat who keeps hocking him around and saying that this is okay, so he's got to go into print or into writing to actually say that is, and therefore the rabbi's view, the Alshech says, is really wrong. Then you have, this is the second tshuva that's important. The third tshuva that really comes up is tshuva number 5, source number 5. This is found actually funneled in the response of the Ramah of Moshe Isselis. It's not written by Rav Moshe Isselis. Ramah himself has another opinion. But in the 16th century, he refers to a tshuva of by Rav Shmuel Yehuda Katzenbalgin of Padua. It appears once again in the tshuva of the Ramah. And he says, and it's elementary knowledge in our land not to use these hybrid, these murkav esrogim, even in a shas atchak, even in a time of emergency. And I've heard from my father and master of blessed memory, Rav Meir Katzenbogen, who was called the Maron Padua, very famous achron, that it occurred once in Padua, the community had one etrog. They had one etrog that arrived. You can understand, getting an etrog in those days was very difficult. And it was in transit from the Ashkenazi congregation to the Sephardic congregation. They shared this etrog between the Sephardim and the Ashkenazim in the city. Unbelievable, Jews getting along together, sharing one etrog.
Necessity.
A necessity, yes. And what happened? So he calls it a studento. Calls it a student came along, a non-Jewish student, probably a seminary student is what he means, a priest in training who wanted to do a mitzvah for his religion, who stole the etrog from the messenger and wouldn't give it back. And they had to pay a lot of money to redeem this one etrog, because otherwise if they didn't have this etrog, which they knew was not a hybrid, they would have to resort to using the other etrogim in town, which were hybrids. They could get those apparently fairly easily. And therefore it had... They had recently come to from the province of Padua, Drogim, who is permissible is not clear. And then he goes through in this tshuva, which I didn't mention, some of the identifying traits that were accepted in these areas, distinguishing them from pure red esrogim between hybrids themselves. So that's really another very important tshuva that goes through it. It's quoted in the Shilas and Tshuvas of the Ramah. So it's not written by the Ramah himself. The Rav Moshe Isselis himself actually says that he was willing to use Murkavim in a Shas Atchak, in an emergency. An emergency means there's nothing else to use. There's nothing around. That's it. There's got one etrog.
And he's the Posek.
That's correct. That's the Psak. The Psak is, he said that you can use it in the emergency. He actually begins by saying initially, he does not think they're correct. But he hears, he says, you know what, if you look at some of what the Talmud talks about etrogim, it applies also to lemons and to oranges. They smell nice, they look nice, the same kind of taste. It stays on the tree from year to year. It's not only etrogim apparently, it's also oranges and lemons. And you see, they're not etrogim. And similarly, the hybrid, the murkav, is also, it looks like an etrog. It is a citrus fruit, but it really is not considered an etrog. But at the very end of his tshuva, the Ramad does relent and say, but you know, and if you're really stuck, is the only thing around for miles and miles and miles, kilometers and kilometers and kilometers, okay? And you can't get another one, and that's it, it's that or nothing. So he says he's not going to, he will not cast aspersions on the earlier generations who had the custom to pronounce the blessing on such nesok at the time of need, Shas Atchak. But we should not leave the realm of possibility to pronounce the blessing on such an etrog in case of extreme Shas, really super Shas Atchak, that there's no other possibility of getting some different type of etrog. So that's pretty lenient considered to most of where many of the tshuvos go, that b'shas atchak would allow it. However, otherwise it really seems to be put on the side. He calls it shalom b'shas, shalom b'docha gadol, a really very difficult shas atchak, that there's no other possibility. There are a number of other tshuvot that come up, and I just kind of want to move to some of them that I want to just point out to you. The Bach has a tshuva about this, not to use the etrogim that are murkav. That's number 7. You can just flip through it yourself. And he does say, the Bach does say as well, that you shouldn't protest against those who do. I don't believe in it, he says, but you know what? I know that there are people who have been using them. This is, once again, we're getting 16th, 17th century. There's a tshuva from the Pani Meiro. This is source number 8. This is Pani Meiros was a Hungarian rabbi, Rav Meir ben Yitzchak. He was born in 1708, so this is bringing us into already the beginning of the 18th century. And he points out, and this is maybe really the source of a lot of the Shas Adchak tshuvos, actually these hybrids have the smell and taste of a real etrog with no perceptible difference, so that those who rely on the early generations are b'dieved and pronounce a blessing on them have fulfilled their obligation after the fact. They look like an etrog, they smell like an etrog, it is an etrog. What defines an etrog? If it looks like an etrog, it's an etrog. It walks like an etrog, quacks like an etrog, it's an etrog. So he actually says once again similarly that b'dieved, or more importantly, Shas Adchak, and b'dieved, there's nothing else we could rely upon it, but surely it's not the ideal type of thing that we should actually be looking upon. You find the tshuva of the Magen Avraham, source number 9. Just want to barrel through some of these so I can really get to talk about the Corfu issue. Once again, the Magen Avraham is opposed to using this. He invalidates making a bracha against on this. He says an aveira was done in order to make this kind of a fruit. He doesn't say it's a different thing, but he says you made an aveira by combining different fruits together. And then you have this tshuva of source number 10 from the Shvut Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, who dies in 1733. Once again, I told you we're getting up to the 18th century at this point. And once again, he relates to an incident that happened some years before in Prague. This is a really fascinating kind of incident because you see the kind of pressures that were sometimes being brought to bear on the great Gedolim. You see the pressure to bear being brought on Rav Shapsak Kohn, the Shach. And the story is as follows, and I think I put it there for you on source number 10 in the English summation of it. One year there was only hybrid Asrogim available in Prague, and the rabbis, of course, said you can't use them. And, of course, there were some people who got a little excited. There's always people getting excited. Some belligerent types who wanted to display the ruling, and through smooth talk convinced the Rav Shapsak Kohn, the Shach, known as the Shach, who was visiting Prague at the time, to issue a ruling that you could make a bracha in a time of emergency. And they even forced the Chazan, the Altmuh Shul in Prague, to make the bracha on the Etrog. This was the first day of Sukkot. Everybody's waiting. And what happens? This is such a moment of nervousness that the Chazan drops the Etrog at the last minute. Boom, it breaks. The Kapitan breaks off. The Etrog splits in half. And everybody is saved from using this dubious kind of Etrog, like a simon and a shamayim. Or either that, or just kind of clumsy hands in a moment of shaking, and everybody watching on him. But most importantly, if you look later on, what happened when there were letters came from Prague, to Prague, to rabbis from Germany and Poland and Moravia, which said it's wrong, and at the very end of his lifetime, the Shach actually retracted his decision. Fascinating story here. Sent a letter to the rabbis in Prague and asked for forgiveness. And the author of this tshuva, the Yaakov Reischer, concludes by saying the consensus of early and late authorities is, of course, that you cannot make a bracha on this esrog, and you should really stay away from them. So once again, you see that in general, you have this either don't do it, or don't do it unless you're really, really, really stuck. There's one tshuva that really goes the other way. And that's, I'm going to skip over 11 from the Chasam Sofer. I'm going to move to a tshuva from Ephraim. I can't really read my handwriting. The tshuva is the Beit Ephraim. Ephraim Zalman Margolis of Brody, who dies in 1828. We don't have the tshuva itself, but we actually do have the tshuva, but summarized here, the Beit Ephraim in the Shari Tshuva in 649. In which, once again, they cite various sources that said that Drogim were invalid. Analyze their reasons and why it's wrong not to use it. And then, he goes through all of it. And then he says at the end of his tshuva, as he goes through it, let's see, make sure I do this correctly here. He says as follows. I'm going to just read some of this together with you. He actually argues, and he says that the fact that the Gemara talks about grafting changes what the fruit is really only if you're grafting to the same kind of tree. So this Gemara has to do with whether a tree is 3 years old or 4 years old. So if I take a different branch and I stick it onto a tree that's already been rooted, it doesn't have to start again the counting. He says, on the other hand, he says if I'm grafting to a different species, it doesn't change what the actual item that you've grafted from, the branch itself is going to change into. So when you put the entire branch of the etrog into a lemon tree, the fact that it gets the nourishment from the ground through the lemon tree doesn't annul what the etrog is. It only really applies specifically to when you're trying to count how many years it's been put in the ground. And therefore, says Rav Margolis, that the Osrogim, he's talking about the Osrogim from Karfu, which were based upon temporary grafts. They started by grafting them to lemon trees, and then once they got it going, they actually moved them to different Etrogim tree and kept them on the real species itself. It was only a temporary kind of graft. They were removed and planted separately, which is far from the real lemon trees. He actually says it's really true. So he is one of the few opinions that actually is supportive of really so using the etrogim if they are from a grafted situation. But by and large, most of the poskim say either one of two things: don't do it, or don't do it unless you really pushed up against the edge. And that's really the history which has remained today. And of course, you go into the etrog story, we'll see it says the Bilti Murkov. They're not Murkovim, and so forth. So I'm going to hold the questions. I want to get this piece in about the stuff in Corfu. So this is really the halachic origins of the halachic history from about the 16th century down to the modern era etrog, and we've gotten much nicer. But let me tell you about what happened in Corfu. So first of all, the Corfu etrogim were known as the nicest of the etrogim, the most beautiful of the etrogim. In fact, that may have been somewhat of their downfall. People said this is too nice to be a real kosher etrog. If it's a real etrog, it's really natural etrog, then it's got to be really lumpy and bumpy and messed up and everything else. Not possible to kind of make it look so nice. You must have mixed something into it as well.
Like the blight in kosher etrog.
Well, it's pretty much the same idea, right? If it's too good to be true, then it's what it is. It's too good to be true.
And don't put them on, right?
No, I don't remember if that's Pitta Mother or not, I don't recall. But that's not the important thing that happens. Anyway, so you've got these people in Corfu who've really managed to kind of develop the trade. They figured out the system. We don't know really what they're doing in terms of, merging them or grafting them as well. But apparently it's by the 18th century, things have really moved into a very good kind of trade and moves into the 19th century. These are the Cadillacs, so these are the Lexuses of the world in terms of etrogim. And people are willing to spend a lot of money to get them. In fact, there are stories about where they would actually dump some of their etrogim in the ocean so that there shouldn't be a glut on the market, reduce the supply so that the price goes up. They're very clever kinds of people. Now, but every once in a while, there are arguments about whether this is really kosher. Not kosher, but they tell you what happens in 1846, there's the biggest explosion probably in all times of halachic machloksim in the 19th century, and it's probably the most ferocious and acrimonious type of halachic debate that takes place at that point, probably in the 19th century, in 19th century Europe. And you know, there's actually a piece by Professor Yosef Salman of Ben-Gurion University about it. But here's what happens. There's this fellow called Alexander Ziskin Mintz, who actually comes from Brody, who earned his livelihood by selling etrogim. And he actually achieved somewhat of a monopoly the previous year on etrogim, not from Corfu, but etrogim from Parga, which is also near Corfu, and it's off the coast of Greece. Now, he publishes in 1846 this booklet called Pri Etz Hadar. He calls it Pri Etz Hadar, which he prohibits the etrogim of Corfu, and he has all kinds of rabbis supporting him and publish one after the other. Not to be confused, the Pri Etz Hadar thing, Rav Kook wrote a Sefer Pri Etz Hadar, the other Sefer, a Kabbalistic Sefer Pri Etz Hadar. This is a specific booklet deals specifically with the etrogim of Corfu. Now, it seems that the catalyst for this, and this is really kind of looking at sociology and playing into halacha, that he had a partner, and his partner was with him in the etrogim business, and then the partner kind of moved off, broke away from him, set up shop in a new area. So in order to stop him, this is the conjecture, of course, very difficult to say, he may have actually put the book together to force his partner out of business to say that his partner, who is dabbling now in Corfu etrogim, was dabbling in etrogim that were really possible. And of course, all the rabbis became lining up one side against the other, and the poor chief rabbi of Corfu was running around saying, no, my etrogim are really kosher, I've got to revisit all the orchards, and so he puts a stempel on it, says, so you don't know what you're talking about. And this goes on, this really is 1846, it goes on for about 20 years, dies down for a bit, resurfaces in 1876, once again, gets reignited, and I'm not quite sure how, but the arguments against it and for it, you either are so much for the Corfu etrogim, or so much against them because you say that they are murkav, they are grafted, or not grafted, or whatever it is, or grafting is okay, but the evet, and the beauty overrides it. So it keeps going back and forth. In fact, by the time it gets into the late 1800s, you're even having people, rabbis lining up from the New World, from Newark, and from other parts of the United States, from really saying that once again it's puzzle. Now, here's what happened. That could have gone on forever and ever, except two events occurred. Two events happened which really influenced the decline of this debate. Number one, in 1891, the Greek population of Corfu, which were never really Ohavei Yisrael to begin with, came up with a blood libel against the Jews. Okay, and this actually is a true story. So when they heard about this, they say, now these Esrogim coming from Corfu, not only is a Suffolk where the kosher, they're dripping in the blood of Jewish children. The children of Zion have been murdered to make a couple of bucks, and you're going to support this kind of business. So it became like an emotional kind of thing that was going up. And here's a quote in the translation from the Avnei Nezer. The Etrogim of Corfu, and you can, by the way, understand the Greeks here. It reminds us of course, the Greeks of the Antiochus story. The Etrogim of Corfu are in the hands of the uncircumcised Greeks, known through the writings to be Amalekites. May their names be erased, and so forth and so on. They're traitors in the blood of Israel. There's hardly a person who will touch them because the Etrogim are drifting with the bloods of the children of Zion. They didn't give you that source. They're still too graphic. That's one thing that happens. That's actually a fairly negative kind of thing. Who wants to deal with blood of Jewish children? Second thing that happens, and this is actually very positive, is at the same time, the communities of Israel, the Moshavim in Israel, are starting up. And there's a trade in Israel, which, by the way, also is subjected to a lot of discussion when there's Morkov, because really, until about 1851, you could not plant this rogim. They were all under the control of the Sultan or the Pasha, whoever was the person in charge. In 1851, the ruler of Palestine or Israel or the Holy Land decided, instead of kind of keeping the monopoly, he would have people pay him a tax to then plant their own trees. Now, I can't tell you what happens when government is given over to private investments, but there were all kinds of questions. Arabs were grafting them, Jews were grafting them, Sephardim, the Ashkenazim couldn't get into the trade, back and forth and back and forth. And then you get to the end of the 19th century, and you get people who say, we have to start supporting the growth of what's going on in Israel. And Rav Kook comes along. Rav Kook really is very supportive of these different Moshavim. Rav Kook travels around. There are stories about going and checking all the Esrogim, the trees themselves, to see whether they were grafted or not grafted, going down to the bottom. I'm finishing in 1 second. I know I started late and late. That's the way it is, guys. And as a result, he comes back and really is on the supports them and tries to push them into, of course, ups the support for it. The last source that you have on the page is really a piece from the Aruch HaShulchan, who pretty much says, you can read it yourself because it's a matter of time, that basically you should support the land of Israel. The halacha is correct, but more importantly, develop the land of Israel. So much so that today, there are still groups that Jews, Esrogim, that are from out of the Eretz Yisrael, Corfu, or different places in Italy and so forth, certain Hasidic groups.
Morocco
on Shemitah year especially. But by and large, the Israeli crop has turned into the beautiful crop that you probably will be buying in Esrog this year, next year, and so forth and so on. So that's when that happens, the Israeli crop moves up in value, in acceptance, and of course what happens to the Carfus argument, it kind of drops down, and the whole system changes based upon the sociological development that goes on in Israel. Thank you very much. Yes. Yes. We'll take the question. I'll take the question in the back, okay?